Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is September 11th, 2019, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Vitamin C, Not Ready for Graduation to Routine Use. And our guest skeptics are two. We have Dr. Erin Willard. She is a PGY3 emergency medicine resident in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. I didn't know you were that popular, Erin, but welcome to the SGEM.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be on the show.
And we also have Dr. Carly Easton. She's an associate professor, Division of Research and Evidence-Based Medicine, Department of Emergency Medicine, University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. Welcome to the SGEM, Carly.
Thanks, Ken.
Well, it is great to be in Arkansas. I've never been to this state before, so this is exciting for me. We traveled down by car from St. Louis. It was about a six-hour drive, and we got to go through a lot of the countryside. It is a beautiful state. It's very green. Of course, Dr. Sapal has us staying at what only Dr. Sapal would consider adequate accommodations. This beautiful hotel that you have downtown called the Capitol. So thank you very much, Tony, for having us here. I'm interested, though, what is the best part of living in Arkansas, Erin?
So I love the outdoors, and so it's a beautiful state. You're very close to the mountains, rivers, lakes, so it's a good opportunity to go somewhere and have some fun on a day off that's pretty close.
It's nice to come from such an academic institution, and the thing that she likes the most, and I like this because this is part of wellness, is to be outside and be in touch with nature. So I think that's fabulous. But I have a more serious question. And that serious question is, who picked the theme music? Because it's not from the 1980s. I had no idea who this Vitamin C group was and the song Graduation. I'm sorry.
What?
I picked it. Being in my last year of residency, Graduation is on my mind. It's something that I've been thinking about. But yeah, more relevant to the episode, the singer's name is Vitamin C.
Well, there is a generation gap that's developed over the last about 10 years now that I've noticed in my practice, and it's that the residents don't get my jokes anymore. So when they're on shift with me and I'll be running a code and I'll go, they're only mostly dead. And they look at me like, oh my God, Dr. Milne, you are dark, right? And I'm like, the Princess Bride, people. And so I recognize now that there's this knowledge gap. And so what I do for residents is when they come to me for their 1 month community rotation, I give them a USB key with five movies from the 1980s, and I flip the classroom, and I encourage them to watch those five movies during the one-month rotation so they'll understand my jokes, or when I'm questioning them and I say, anyone, anyone, Bueller, and they don't just roll their eyes and go, ha 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 ha. But enough about the 1980s, because I could go on. Who's got the case presentation for this podcast?
I've got it. So this case is a 45-year-old female in the ED who is being admitted to the ICU for septic shock secondary to a UTI. She's been given fluids, antibiotics, and is currently maintaining adequate MAP on low-dose vasopressors. You are ready to call the ICU and get her admitted. But you remember seeing in the news there was a study claiming vitamin C could cure sepsis. You wonder if giving vitamin C will affect her outcome.
Well, there has been a huge buzz in the media over the last few years about vitamin C cocktail, and that is vitamin C, hydrocortisone, and thiamine as a possible cure for sepsis. And this was based on a well-known critical care physician, Dr. Paul Merrick.
Dr. Merrick published a retrospective before and after study that included vitamin C cocktail, reporting an impressive number needed to treat of three to prevent one death due to sepsis.
So that was an NNT of three with that vitamin C cocktail for a very solid patient-oriented outcome, alive or dead.
For the scientific rationale on why vitamin C therapy may help septic patients, check out Josh Farkas' post on PalmCrit.
Now, we reviewed Dr. Merrick's observational study on SGEM number 174. A dozen skeptics from around the world commented on the validity of the study and included my EBM mentor, Dr. Andrew Worster, who started Best Evidence in Emergency Medicine, or BEAM, and legend of emergency medicine, Jerome Hoffman.
The SGM bottom line was that vitamin C, hydrocortisone, and thiamine was associated with lower mortality in severe septic and septic shock patients in this one small, single-centered, retrospective before and after study, but causation has yet to be demonstrated.
A number of clinical trials are currently underway in an attempt to replicate Dr. Merrick's findings. The existing evidence to support vitamin C use in patients with septic shock is weak and has been summarized in a systematic review meta-analysis.
All right, so for the show, we want to ask a specific clinical question. So what's the question we're going to try to answer on today's podcast?
Does the administration of vitamin C to an adult critically ill ICU patient or cardiac surgery patient decrease mortality?
And the reference?
So the primary author is Patsu. The title of the article is The Effect of Vitamin C on Clinical Outcome in Critically Ill Patients, a Systematic Review with Meta-Analysis of Randomized Controlled Trials. This was published in Critical Care Medicine in June 2019.
And so this is talking about cutting that KT window down, because it was published in June, and here we are in September doing a structured critical review of this publication. We like to run through the PICO, and that stands for the population intervention, the comparison or control, and the outcome. So what was the population in this study?
This systematic review included randomized trials examining critically ill adult ICU or cardiac surgery patients.
And then there were some exclusions, and I'll list those in the show notes. What was the intervention?
Any type of vitamin C formulation or regimen.
And the comparator?
Placebo or no therapy.
And let's run through the outcomes. What was the primary outcome?
It was mortality at the longest point of follow-up.
And again, a very poo-oriented outcome, right? Patient-oriented outcome. Dichotomous, alive or dead. How about secondary outcomes?
AKI, supraventricular tachycardia, ventricular arrhythmia, stroke, ICU, and hospital length of stay.
So here's what the author said in their conclusions, quote, in a mixed population of ICU patients, vitamin C administration is associated with no significant effect on survival, length of ICU or hospital stay. Now in cardiac surgery, beneficial effects of postoperative atrial fibrillation, ICU or hospital length of stay remains unclear. However, the quality and quantity of evidence is still insufficient to draw firm conclusions, not supporting neither discouraging the systemic administration of vitamin C in these populations. Vitamin C remains an attractive intervention for future investigation aimed to improve clinical outcome. End of quote. All right, so now we have a quality checklist to go through. And for systematic reviews, there are 7 quality checklist questions. Who's doing these ones?
We're splitting them up.
You're splitting them up? Okay. All right. So the first question is the clinical question sensible and answerable?
So overall, we felt it was a reasonable question.
It's a yes, no question.
Well,
you can use unsure. You can say yes, no, or unsure.
We said overall yes. Although we wish they were a little more narrow in their questions. So they included not only septic patients, but postoperative patients that were not septic. So we wish maybe they had been a little more narrow.
A little bit more focused,
yeah,
right?
More focused.
With a specific focused question. All right. Question number 2, the search for studies was detailed and exhaustive.
So we felt yes, the search was overall detailed and exhaustive. So they independently researched 3 databases. They searched conference proceedings and went through reference lists by hand, which are things that we like to see.
We refer to those as the gray literature, right? When you're searching that literature, it's considered the gray literature.
They had no language restrictions, which is important.
So they included American?
So they included all languages. And they used the PRISMA guidelines when they went through the search. So they and they actually published their search criteria that they use, which was nice. The one thing we wish to see is that they didn't specifically say they searched clinicaltrials.gov, which is if you're ever doing a prospective trial where you're enrolling patients and randomizing them to a treatment, you have to put that in clinicaltrials.gov. And so there's a lot of unpublished trials in clinicaltrials.gov that I wish they would have at least explicitly said they searched that database.
Okay, the third question, the primary studies, were they of high methodological quality?
We're unsure. So the authors extracted information about areas of clinical heterogeneity, conflicts of interest. They talked about internal validity and bias. But of the 44 studies, they categorized those 36 of those studies as having a high risk of bias.
So let's put a point on that. 44 studies and 36 were rated as high risk of bias. And so this gets back to the presentation earlier about evidence-based medicine and systematic reviews and meta-analyses sitting above randomized control trials. I would take one really good randomized control trial and I would have more confidence in that as opposed to a systematic review and meta-analysis that included a whole bunch of crappy little studies. Now, I'm not saying this had a whole bunch of crappy little studies, but I think it's an important point to make that just because it's a systematic review and meta-analysis, you've got to look at the ingredients, and that doesn't get you closer to the truth necessarily. It depends on how good or what is the quality of the included studies.
And for those of you following along in the manuscript, you might be looking for the bias table or the bias chart. And they actually don't have one that's in the manuscript. There is an appendix that has that available, which does break down each of the trials that they included and what parts of the trials had higher levels of bias.
The fourth point, the assessment of the studies, were they reproducible?
We felt yes. They did have detailed descriptions of their methods, how they assessed bias, how they abstracted the data, which studies they contacted the authors to receive additional data or clarification, how they came to their conclusions. So we felt for the bias assessment and for their overall methods, it was overall reproducible.
So the fifth question, the outcomes, were they clinically relevant, like mortality?
Yes.
All right, the sixth question, was there low statistical heterogeneity for the primary outcomes?
No, the statistical heterogeneity for the primary outcome was low to moderate. The I-squared listed for all ICU patients included in the study was about 36%.
Yeah, and that's the metric we use to quantify heterogeneity, and zero means none, and 100% means apples and oranges, or more like apples and a rock. So as that heterogeneity statistic gets higher and higher, we question whether or not it was reasonable to meta-analyze those studies because the differences between them. The seventh and final question, the treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
No.
There we go. All right, so let's run through those results. They included 44 randomized control trials, like we said, with 16 from the ICU setting and 2 from the cardiac surgery setting. What was the main outcome?
The main outcome was they found no significant difference in mortality with the administration of vitamin C.
And so for that primary outcome, mortality, they broke it up into the ICU patients and the cardiac surgery patients. So for the ICU patients, what did they find for mortality?
So they found no statistical difference in mortality. They found 28% in the vitamin C group for only ICU patients versus 29% in the control group.
And for the cardiac surgery patients?
For the cardiac surgery patient, there was also no statistical difference.
And how about their secondary outcomes for the ICU patients?
There was no statistical difference in AKI, ICU, or hospital length of stay.
And for the cardiac surgery patients?
There was less postoperative AFib, ICU, and hospital length of stay, but there was no significant difference in AKI, stroke, or ventricular arrhythmia.
Carly and Aaron, you know what time it is?
To talk nerdy.
Oh, it's time to talk nerdy. Top of the class there, Aaron. Okay, so yes, it is time to talk nerdy. One of my favorite parts. I love talking nerdy. So we are going to go through my favorite number of points, 5. Why 5? I can count to it on one hand. All right, and I'm going to lead off with the first nerdy point, and that is about the focused question. And you mentioned that earlier, Carly. We would have preferred to have a much more focused question. This systematic review and meta-analysis looked at critically ill patients, whether they were in the ICU or post-operative cardiac surgery patients. There is a potential that vitamin C could have a patient-oriented benefit identified through a systematic review and meta-analysis. However, the heterogeneity of the included population could hide any subgroup demonstrating efficacy. We would have liked to have seen that question of whether or not patients suffering from sepsis or severe sepsis or septic shock would have a mortality benefit from the administration of vitamin C.
So the second point, the quality of trials. One of the weaknesses of this systematic review is the quality of the included trials. The vast majority, that was 36 out of 44 of the included trials, were deemed to be of high risk of bias. There is hierarchy of evidence-based medicine where systematic reviews are considered better than randomized controlled trials. However, we would have more confidence in a well-designed, multi-centered, blinded, randomized, placebo-controlled trial than a systematic review containing poor quality studies. Mashing low quality studies in a meat grinder does not get us any closer to the truth.
I like that about a meat grinder. Now, I grew up on an apple farm, and so we always talk about making great apple pies. And so I think of systematic reviews. I think of systematic reviews. You see how we roll? I consider systematic reviews like making a great apple pie. And you've got to have great ingredients. You've got to have beautiful, wonderful apples, great unrefined sugar, cinnamon, a great pie crust. And you put all that ingredients together and you have a great apple pie. But like I said, I grew up on an apple orchard on a farm. Our next door neighbor had a dairy farm, and they have things over there called cow pies. Do you understand what that means? They're about the same size as an apple pie. You find them in the field. And if you add that to an apple pie, it does not make the apple pie taste any better. So again, we want to see high quality studies put into a meta-analysis so we can get a really good answer.
The third point, when we're talking nerdy, is about heterogeneity. The statistical heterogeneity represented by the I-squared metric was moderately high. So like Ken said before, the I-squared metric is one of the metrics that we use to judge heterogeneity. When we talk about heterogeneity, there's two different kinds. There's kind of the heterogeneity of the methods of the included trials. So did they use different doses, different randomization methods? How different were the actual treatments? And then there's heterogeneity of the results. So the I-squared is a measure of the consistency of the results between the trials. So is one trial positive? Is one trial negative? How different are the results among all of the included trials? So for this, it was 36%. So when you think about the I-squared metric, it ranges from 0 to 100%. When you get around that 30 to 40% range, that's when you kind of start being a little more skeptical of the study, because that means that the results between each of the included trials was probably a little bit higher than you like. If you get to that 50% mark, that's definitely too high. So 36% is approaching that. We don't really like this number. That's pretty high. We would like to see that number be a lot less. Because of that, you know, if they had a better I-squared, then maybe we would be able to believe these results a little more. But they failed to demonstrate efficacy. We still do not know if there's a mortality benefit to vitamin C.
Now, Carly, I noticed that your voice was, we were out late last night, and your voice was cracking a little bit, getting a little harsh, you know, and stuff like that. And so in Canada, we have a fix for that. Now, some people suggest taking a little spoonful of honey, but what I recommend you do is you take a shot of pure maple syrup, and that'll be sure to give you that smooth audio quality. You go ahead and take a shot. All right. Okay. And we will move on to number four. Go ahead. Throw it back. Oh, go. Oh. Now you have to go smooth.
Ooh, that's really good.
Oh, yeah.
That's really good.
You don't need no pancakes.
The next point is harm. As with many studies, there was limited data on harm of the intervention. Most of the studies included in this review did not systematically assess adverse events due to vitamin C administration. While it is probably safe, it would be intellectually inaccurate to claim safety.
All right, and for the fifth point, this is about burden of proof. In epistemology, and epistemology is the philosophy of how do we know things? How do we attain knowledge? And when we obtain knowledge, is it strong enough to move us to believe the outcome? In other words, are we justified based on the evidence? So in epistemology, the burden of proof is on those making the claim. And advocates of vitamin C claim that it provides a patient-oriented benefit. Research studies are set up with the null hypothesis, no effect. Evidence needs to be presented to reject the null hypothesis. And at this point in time, the burden of proof to support the claim that vitamin C has a patient-oriented outcome has not been met. Now, that doesn't mean that we can make the claim that vitamin C doesn't work. That would be shifting the burden of proof. But rather, we don't have enough evidence at this time to warrant rejecting the null hypothesis. And I just wanted to make that distinction. All right, it's time to comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions.
So the authors felt there was no mortality benefit, and we agree that there appears to be no mortality benefit, but that the secondary outcomes should only be viewed as hypothesis generating.
Wasn't that better?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's better. Okay. Thank you.
All right. So how about a SGEM bottom line, Erin?
There is not enough evidence to support the routine use of vitamin C in critically ill patients.
Now we need to circle back and resolve that case.
So you remember that there is no good evidence that vitamin C treatment in critical illness like sepsis has benefit, and you choose not to give this therapy to your patient. The patient is transitioned to the floor the following day and ultimately discharged home without end organ damage.
All right, Erin, you're at that third year. You're about to graduate. You're assimilating and synthesizing all this information. How are you going to take this systematic review and meta-analysis and apply it clinically?
So from this, we gather that vitamin C may prove beneficial in the prevention of postoperative supraventricular arrhythmia like AFib. However, the available evidence has significant limitations and should be viewed as hypothesis generating for our cardiology colleagues. Further high-quality research is needed in this area before we can confidently reject the null hypothesis.
And now one of the most difficult things to do, and Chris Carpenter identified this in his presentation about evidence-based medicine, is how do you take, this is pretty high-end nerdy stuff, right? A systematic review and meta-analysis. And how do you bring that to the patient's bedside and have a conversation about the evidence and what you're going to do in a shared decision-making model? So how do you do that, Carly?
So here's what I would tell my patient. We are going to admit you to the intensive care unit and give you antibiotics through an IV for your serious infection. You may have heard in the media about vitamin C being a cure for sepsis, which is a medical term for a serious infection. We hope that this is true, but at this time, we do not have enough good evidence to routinely give it to patients.
It's time to announce the Keener contest. Last week's winner was Dr. Terrence Creighton, a PGY2 emergency medicine resident at Detroit Medical Center. He knew that William Enthoven published the first ECG depicting atrial fibrillation. What's the Keener contest this week, Erin?
Who is credited with coining the term meta-analysis and published one of the first systematic reviews in 1979 on the inverse relationship between class size and pupil academic achievement?
Oh, good question, since we're talking about a meta-analysis. So if you know the answer to this week's Gunner question, send an email to thesjam@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Now, you have to play to win, and you have to win to find out what the cool skeptical prize is. But it exists. It is real. And I will mail it to anyone in the world. So if you're the first person to send me via social media the correct answer to this question, you will receive a cool skeptical prize. Now, there is some other FOMED resources on this topic, and I will include those in the show notes. But I do want to thank my wonderful host, Dr. Tony Sapal, for inviting me to come here today. And of course, I'd also like to thank Dr. Erin Willard for coming. Thank you, Erin. And our associate professor, Dr. Carly Easton. Thank you very much. Now, for the final thing, we can either do this in stereo with you guys reading the tagline, or you can get the audience, you can crowdsource it and get the audience to say it as well with you at the same time. What would you like to do? Would you like to do it in stereo, or would you like to involve the audience?
Let's get the audience.
Yep.
Okay, so we did this earlier where on the count of three, you guys remember that, thou shalt count to three, thou shalt not count to four, five is way off, thou shalt only count to two if subsequently followed by three. Does anybody know where that's from? Thank you. Yes, the holy hand grenade. Whoop! Okay, so here we go. On the count of three, we are going to give the SJAM tagline. One, two, three.
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Nice job, everybody. Thank you.